Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. And we're back. August 20th, 2022. Fall is encroaching. We are now in approaching late summer. It's time to grab the beach ball, the fishing pole, the six-pack for one more weekend. That would be the business union holiday they call Labor Day. Now, we all celebrate Labor Day May 1st, but we're going to let them have their fun. 3-day weekend. The Wobblies got a convention. That's going to be 3 days of just madness, just hardcore labor organizing going through their numbers. If you're not signed up to the IWW yet, it's too late, but go to IWW.org, and a window will pop up that'll ask if you want to be a sex worker. Now that's in IU, which is Industrial Union 690. And it's just, I mean, don't be offended. I mean, we just assume everyone is a sex worker, at least giving up their pound of flesh to Caesar for a slave wage. So shortly in the future, we hope to see basic income, some sort of basic income with full benefits, what we know as full benefits as medical, education, housing. It's the only way we can save the planet. And free housing for everyone. We have to take down the border. No more borders, people. And what I'm understanding is we got some folks out in Kansas that listen to our podcast, and they don't understand how we can live up here with black and brown folks and get along. And they're just like any other neighbors, you know. And so you try to do a favor here and there, you know, and y'all try to take, you know, keep an eye on each other for the most part. I mean, I'm kind of outward in that way, you know. So I have a tendency to talk to people and get people talking in neighborhoods, and but you don't have to. You know, you can be like that Clint Eastwood guy in the movie Gran Torino. Maybe we ought to do a review of Gran Torino sometime. Nonetheless, we got a lot of stuff. Probably won't get through everything. We're going to talk about a little later on. We're going to talk about Kansas City. City Hall, Sue's the Attorney General, and there's like some double talk. I don't like the Attorney General. I don't like the mayor of Kansas City. You know, nothing personal against the guy. It's just these positions require a certain type, you know, of ambition.
be it blind like Richard Nixon or authoritarian like Lyndon LaRouche. So we're going to start out with a McCarthy era, a McCarthy biography. You know, the kinder, gentler approach. Turns out McCarthy didn't drink himself to death because he lost the case. He was just already in like the third stages. He was a rocker and a roller. I mean, he's the guy. You know, like when George Bush was president, he said, "Oh, he's a guy I'd have a beer with." Yeah, this on the receiving end, that's called third stage alcoholism. But I'm not gonna, that's all I'm gonna say about Joseph McCarthy. We're gonna let Arthur Herman talk about that. I got a bunch of recaps. I don't know if anybody has paid attention to the news, but. I can't even begin, right? So I really like the Twitter news. You know, I've got the MSNBC, the CBS, the ABCs, the Newsmax, the Fox News. We got all that stuff on the griddle. Okay, this is what we're serving up tonight. We got a spicy entree. Okay, fajitas, if you will. Okay, so the Espionage Act. That's, you know, I was thinking about this on the ride home that in 1916, 18 Wobblies died of pneumonia in Jackson County, Missouri. And it's like, oh, well, we don't know where the jail is where they actually died. And I'm like, well, hey, how about that historical marker where Frank James was jailed, you know, right across the street from Jesse James Bank? Well, and I'm not, this is mere coincidence, but Emmanuel Cleaver is now, has his office right across from the old jail. So, I mean, you know, he talks to spirits, and I'm not talking about, like, cinnamon snops or you know, vodka martini spirits. I'm saying, that motherfucker talks to spirits. Hey. You know, I mean, there's all kinds. It's just a very strange time. Is all I'm saying. And so, to get back to all you folks out there that maybe you're like, hey, yeah, I want the borders closed. I don't want health care. I don't want health care for women. Y'all need to jump off that Trump train. You know what I'm saying? Jump off, get off, stay off. You know. I mean, you know, because look, the pacifists are saying, oh, we need to love the MAGA Trump people. We need to love the white supremacists. We need to love the Christian identity. We need to love the neo-Nazis. Hey, we're not going to wash your little pecker for you. We're not here for that, okay? That's what I'm saying. I got a really good one, a teacher in Tennessee. They were like, she's like a grade school teacher. She's got a library in her room, probably, you know, knows what children like to read, you know, and motivation for kids to get their work done is they get to read a book if they get their work done. No, we got some frickin' Ayatollahs in Tennessee. And, Yeah, think about like taking Pat Robertson, pulling his pants down, and whipping him with a switch. That's basically what this grade school teacher is doing. And I got a clip from a kindergarten teacher that's talking to Man Baby Trump. And so that's going to be a surprise clipped into some of this stuff. So I my main man, Mike, on the boards, if you could, Mike, let's talk about Joseph McCarthy, and we'll cleanse the palate. We'll get all this dank and unsettling stuff I just talked about. We'll just get it off the palate. And so this one's 509. Hit it, Mike.
It was a conference call. Well, what I point out in the book is that one of the accusations that they had constantly made about Joe McCarthy was that he played fast and loose with the facts, that his accusations really lacked substance and were, in a sense, exaggerated by a kind of hysterical rhetoric about the threat, about Reds under the bed and Soviet spies in the White House and control from the Kremlin, et cetera, et cetera. And what I do point out, and I'm not the first one to point this out, is that much of that playing fast and loose with the facts and much of that hysterical rhetoric was employed by his political opponents as well. And one of the things that I want to point out here in the book and to make clear to people who don't remember the time is the degree to which we have to realize that this was a bitterly partisan era. The emotions ran very, very high about how to conduct the Cold War, about how to deal with the threat of Stalinism, both abroad but also at home. You had American soldiers dying in Korea. The Korean War is really the vivid backdrop for all of McCarthy's career here. There was a bitter, bitter partisan battle here in which people were prepared to say almost anything to blacken the reputations and to smear their political opponents. McCarthy did it, Republicans and his Republican allies did it, but we also have to remember that the Democrats were quite prepared to do the same thing and often did against McCarthy, calling him a Nazi sympathizer and talking about his investigations as posing a threat to American democracy and so on, charges which really don't, in the light of historical evidence and historical perspective, don't hold any kind of water. Well, you know, it's very interesting. The professional reviewers who've read the book, including the professional historians, really don't know what to make of it. They have never really read a book quite like this because it doesn't take the sort of obvious sides in the case. It doesn't repeat the kinds of conventional pieties about either Joe McCarthy or about the 1950s and the Red Scare. And because they haven't really read a book that's like this, that it approaches it in this way, it's necessary for reviewers, I think, in many ways, to try and find a way to sort of bring it down to the sort of recognizable category. So it's assumed that because I'm not overtly anti-McCarthy, and I actually sort of try to correct some of the myths and legends that have grown up about McCarthy as being this, you know, this icon of evil, this tremendous anti-democratic demagogue, et cetera, because I'm not anti-McCarthy, therefore I must be pro-McCarthy, which I'm not. And therefore it's also assumed that because I say McCarthy is not the sort of villain that he's been cast to being, that I therefore must be making the Democrats and liberals as the villains, which is false. It's a book that tries to examine this in as cool and detached and dispassionate a way as you can. The man, the times, the issue, the perplexing issue of domestic communism and how to conduct the Cold War. And for a lot of reviewers, this is that picture was taken during the Army-McCarthy hearings. It's McCarthy giving a lecture at the front of the committee table about communist cells around the United States and their links to American Army and Air Force bases. On the other side of it, it is, in that sense, it's a crop photograph because also the larger picture is a picture of Joseph Welch on the left sitting and listening to all of this with a expression of disgusted skepticism on his face. The family seems to have retained some of those papers. A previous historian, previous biographer, who tried to get access to them, they seem to be kept at Marquette University. I guess that's where they are, under seal. Not in the family's possession, but at Marquette University. Tried to get access to them, failed to do so, but was told by a family friend, he mentions this in the preface, was told by a family friend that there was really nothing of great interest there, that most of it was just simply junk mail from McCarthy's Senate office, which is not difficult to believe. Joe McCarthy never wrote down anything. He was an oral man. He was not someone who wrote down things. He never kept a diary. He was probably the least introspective person that you could possibly find. personal papers would not be very revealing at all, even if they did, in fact, no matter what kinds of materials you would find there. Joe McCarthy was, what he appeared to be in public. And it's in the public record, in the public man, that the book is really focused on. An article that was done about Joe McCarthy shortly after he made the Wheeling speech, sort of what's all this fuss about the State Department and who's this Joe McCarthy anyway. So there are photographs that have not been seen before. A young lawyer by the name of Brent Bozell, the two of them penned a book called McCarthy and His Enemies, which was basically a defense of McCarthy's charges against the State Department and against the Truman administration. There seems to have been some talk about him working as a speechwriter for Joe McCarthy. Joe's wife, Jean Kerr, wanted Bill to come on board, it seems. But McCarthy is important later on because it is Buckley who will single-handedly, in a sense, resurrect the conservative movement with his founding of the National Review. Brent Bozell was married to Patricia Buckley. Drew Pearson was the Matt Drudge of the 40s, a radio commentator and newspaper columnist, a kind of glorified gossip columnist, really. And he and McCarthy crossed swords a number of times on issues. Pearson was, like a lot of liberal anti-communists, outraged by McCarthy's charges against the Truman administration and against the Democratic Party. He saw them as wildly reckless, which a lot of them were, of course. And they became bitter, bitter personal enemies. And Anderson worked for Pearson, really sort of learned the trade. The slap story is that they went to a dinner hosted by a leading Washington hostess who decided it would be fun to put these two bitter personal enemies side by side at the same table. After a series of bitter exchanges at the table, in which almost certainly McCarthy, you know, was drinking more and more bourbon, they met again in the cloakroom on their way out. And McCarthy's impulse was to grab at him and to slap him across the face. And then it seems, according to McCarthy's later versions, but again, you can never really trust McCarthy. He's always happy to embellish the truth. Also, kneed him in the groin, pushed him down into the cloakroom, you know, the back where the coats are and so on. It was Richard Nixon, who was at the same dinner, who had to really pull McCarthy off of Pearson and keep him from really pummeling the man. Roy Cohn worked as McCarthy's chief legal counsel when he became chairman of the Subcommittee on Investigations in 1953. He was a brash, precocious, street-smart kid who actually did know his way around the anti-communism and the investigation of domestic subversion. But he is more than any other person responsible, I think, for McCarthy's fall. It is every other person except Joe McCarthy, in that McCarthy became absolutely mesmerized by Cohn's brilliance, his audacity, his seeming grasp of what was essential and how to get things done. And Cohn gave him consistently disastrous advice and really pushed McCarthy off into a series of investigations which would cost McCarthy both, first of all, cost him his public support, but then also cost him his career. His investigations of the Voice of America, for example, his investigations of the U.S. Army, which led directly to the confrontation with the Eisenhower White House. All of these things were done at the behest and at the urging of Roy Cohn.
You say he was only 26 years old when he went
yes,
to work for him?
That's right.
And Bobby Kennedy was 27 at that time?
It was a young, brash, youthful, fresh-faced team. This was the image that was being presented here about them. Kennedy and Cohn hated each other. They came to almost came to blows, in fact, later on. And Kennedy reluctantly resigned from the committee because he realized that there wasn't room for both of them on McCarthy's staff. And although there is nothing that suggests that there was any kind of physical relationship between Cohn and Schein, there was a strong emotional intimacy and emotional dependency between Cohn and Schein, which was really quite striking. A lot of people who knew Cohn's family members, who knew him as being this incredibly outgoing and forceful personality, a person with, you know, kind of the embodiment of chutzpah, and here he was sort of mooning after this, not terribly bright, not very cerebral, younger man. That relationship between them and Cohn's desire to keep David Shine from going into the Army when he's drafted, to keep him on the staff, is what ultimately leads to McCarthy's downfall, because it is Cohn's efforts, his desperate efforts to get special treatment for Private David Shine.
What year?
This would be in 1953-54.
General Eisenhower's president.
Yeah, Eisenhower's president at this point. The Army is in the Defense Department is in Republican hands. But it is that effort by Cohn that gives the Defense Department then leverage to try and end McCarthy's investigations and probes into their security program. Wofford Curry is one of the shadowiest figures of the whole maze of Soviet espionage and Soviet agents at work in the highest reaches of the federal government. He was an aide to President Roosevelt. He was almost certainly, and we know this from the Venona decrypts, which have recently been made public, the project name for the decoding and deciphering of intercepted KGB cables that had passed between Washington and New York and other KGB stations comes in 1995, is when these have been made public. And what was known to security officers for a long time is now known to historians and to the general public, and that is that Curry was among the most active of these recruited Soviet agents. John Stewart Sturris was one of the brightest of the so-called China hands. He was a principal target of McCarthy's accusations about members of the Truman administration, the State Department, being, if not actually communists, than being sympathetic and secretly sympathetic to the communist cause and giving, for that reason, bad advice that would guarantee the victory for Mao's communists as opposed to and the defeat of the Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists. And he became a principal target and a real hot spot of contention between Republicans and Democrats about the fundamental integrity of the kind of policy advice America was getting during the Chinese Civil War, in fact, for the whole Cold War in Asia. Owen Lattimore was another figure, the kind of spiritual godfather for the China hands. And that picture shows him on his leaving the Tidings Committee hearing room after he had testified against McCarthy. And you can see McCarthy, if you look at the four figures, that quartet in the foreground, McCarthy's the one on the upper right. Miller Tidings was senator from Maryland, and he headed the special Senate committee that was set up to investigate McCarthy's charges against the State Department. And they came out with a report that basically exonerated all of the figures who McCarthy had named as being either communists or communist sympathizers, including Owen Lattimore, including John Stewart Service. McCarthy accused Tidings and the Democrats who controlled the committee of conducting a whitewash, of using it for partisan purposes. And I think that any kind of objective look at the Tidings report and the way in which they did systematically ignore the evidence that was presented, not just by McCarthy, but by their own investigators, you have to say that in this case, at least, McCarthy had something of a point. From the people that I've interviewed who did know him, he was someone who was a warm, engaging, intensely physical man. He was the kind of person who corners you and buttonholes you at a party, takes hold of your lapel, has his arm around you from the other side. Who is charming and engaging, has the ability to, you know, this sort of gruff and rather vulgar sense of humor here. He's the kind of person who's, very, very popular in male locker rooms and in bar rooms here. And most people found him, even his political opponents, found him to be a very likable individual here. The one problem he had was this ferocious temper, which could flare up at unexpected and unpredictable points. And it's one of the things, this intensely physical man suddenly losing his temper, blowing up at imagined slights and insults, and firing back at people with really harsh and nasty personal attacks, was one of the things that made him, as a senator, very, very difficult to deal with. Why people didn't want to touch him, didn't want to deal with him.
Now, the other names that are still around, Anthony Lewis, Tony Lewis, the liberal columnist for the New York Times.
That's right. He's a friend of Roy Cohn, and he was the one who dropped off the newspaper to Roy Cohn, telling him that you are now the target of an investigation and accusations by the U.S. Army. That goes back to New York days. And, in fact, Anthony Lewis was one of the people who was always surprised by Roy Cohn's embrace of the communist issue and turning to McCarthy as a kind of mentor figure. You know, Roy Cohn's family were Democrats. They were Tammany Hall Democrats. Father was a political appointee judge. But we have to understand that Cohn had this unerring eye for the main chance. What is it that's going to guarantee me political success and notoriety in the fastest possible way? What's the fast track to power? And for him, Joe McCarthy was it. This is 1954, during the famous Army-McCarthy hearings. A lot of people have a misconception about the Army-McCarthy hearings. They assume that it was McCarthy investigating the Army that was being televised here for the nation to see. In fact, it was McCarthy who was in the hot seat. It was McCarthy who was the accused of allowing his staff members, including Roy Cohn, to blackmail the Army by threatening investigations in order to get David Shine his special treatment as a new draftee into the Army. He doesn't mention who the person is. I think I have an idea as to who it is, but I'm not going to say. Who worked for Welch, and that after this dramatic scene and the stinging speech that Welch gave to post that he gave to McCarthy for bringing up Fred Fisher's name in the midst of this hearing. Fisher was a lawyer who worked on Welch's staff, who had in student days been a member of the National Lawyers Guild, which was a communist front organization. And the information appeared in the New York Times a couple of weeks before Welch had decided that it was not make sense to have Fred a member of the staff, because he knew that McCarthy and Cohn would probably make an issue out of it. And he and Roy Cohn struck a deal secretly before the hearings opened, that if McCarthy and Cohn would not mention Fred Fisher and his communist affiliations as a way of discrediting Joe Welch and the Army's case, that they would not bring up Roy Cohn's rather suspicious draft deferment that had gotten him out of the Korean War. It was a mutual agreement. You don't bring up an embarrassing episode, and I won't mention this one in exchange for that. And Cohn presented the terms to McCarthy. McCarthy said, fine. Then later on, when Welch was needling and Cohn and giving him a very hard time in the course of the give and take and asking him, give us some names of communists. You think you're an expert on communists? Give us some names now. You know, I don't want to have a single communist name. I want to know who it is on my staff or anywhere who in the U.S. government who's, you know, a communist, and I want those names before sundown. In the midst of all of that, watching Cohn being, in a sense, teased and needled in this way, McCarthy lost his temper and blurted out the example of Fred Fisher. Joseph Welch gave this long, as I say, and quite dramatic and emotionally powerful reply to it about, have you no sense of decency left? And then had a tearful press conference afterwards here, in which, again, he, you know, how could McCarthy have done this to this young man and his lack of decency and all the rest of it. And then after the reporters had gone, when he and his other staff members were leaving, he turned to one of them afterwards, the tears still streaming down his face. And according to the staffer, then Welch said, well, how did it go? That, in other words, he had prepared himself in case McCarthy or Cohn had broken their word. He had prepared this little soliloquy as a way of getting the most emotional impact out of the incident. He didn't trust them, and as it turned out, he was correct. There were a lot of senators who voted for censure, who had their doubts about the grounds for doing so. There had to be a way to stop Joe McCarthy. He had simply gotten out of control, had really sort of stretched the envelope of the institution by his excesses and by his reckless accusations. There had to be a way to stop him. Censure seemed to be the way to do it. But the effect that it had on McCarthy, the tremendous physical and mental decline that McCarthy suffered as a result of that, I think came as a shock to everybody. And his death coming so quickly after the censure, there was a feeling that on the part of the Senate to kind of make amends for this by giving him this kind of funeral, which would ordinarily only be reserved for Supreme Court justices or for presidents.
PJ Harvey, 8:20. I'm sorry, 7:42. Today's 8:20, August 20th. Okay, so you know the Trump, what they call the Trump world, and the MAGA chuds, the MAGA followers. They've got, you know, They've assimilated, not only their own talking points, but their own dog whistles, and there was a MAGA chud that ran into the FBI with a dart gun or something. And got shot in the cornfield in Ohio last week. I think we might have mentioned that. But anyway, they were calling, he pulled a Dilbert. And that is a reference to the cartoon character Dilbert. Okay. So I guess that means, what, you're not Special Forces? You're not SEAL Team 6? Anyway, so it's like, it's a nothing burger. And so anyway, it's interesting that, well, what's the difference between a lone wolf and a Dilbert? You know, was Randy Weaver, was he a lone wolf or a Dilbert? You know, it sounds like a lot of them, maybe with the exception of the Nazis that killed Alan Berg or that killed the labor organizers in North Carolina in 1997, Greensboro, North Carolina, killed five. I guess that was more lone wolf, but that was flat out KKK. Okay, and they were marching like 500 people at a time throughout North Carolina, and that organizer went on to do the shootings, the first mass shootings of this period in Overland Park, Kansas. So we're going to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and you know, she's suffering from some type of cognitive dissonance. And so I just put together a clip of some of the craziest shit I heard this week. Pardon my language. 5:17. Hit it, Mike.
Mandalore Wise says, main reason I think the Cincy thing was a false flag is the claims that Viva Fry told people or told him to be violent.
So
go guard Mar-a-Lago. Anyone who watches Viva is calling BS. So
that's just false. Viva never said that.
Viva like passively read a comment where he's like, oh, I guess people are going to Mar-a-Lago. And
but then
this guy posts like Viva Fry is saying things are happening.
But if you watch the actual clip, and so USA Today wrote this this attack piece on Viva. Because the guy referenced him. And so they said, oh, this guy said he heard it from Viva Frey, even though he didn't go to Mar-a-Lago, which was what the whole thing was about.
Yeah.
And if you actually watch the clip, and Viva has this up on his timeline, he said he's reading this comment, and then he says, oh, yeah, you shouldn't do that. Don't go down there. So
right.
He even says it, that's a bad idea. Don't
it's
do
just
that.
Weird smears.
But they cut that off.
Man, weird.
They smear what they fear. What they fear.
Yeah.
What do we got here? America, let's get that Trump train convo rolling. President Trump stands for us. We must stand with him now. Yeah, apparently people were heading down to Mar-a-Lago to show their support. I don't know if it was protest. I'm an idiot. I swiped myself out of the stream. Yeah, apparently people are going down. I would just be very careful. You go down in that vicinity. Call me a coward. Call me whatever. Would be the name. You go down in that vicinity and you see what they're doing to anybody who is within the vicinity of the Capitol Hill on January 6th. Past is prologue, people.
Had I not fired James Comey, who was a disaster, by the way, it's possible I wouldn't even be standing here right now. Now.
My name is Jared Kushner. I am senior advisor to President Donald J. Trump.
One day he said, I want to come down and I want to have peace in the Middle East.
It's a perfectly qualified team.
How is that?
No, I was joking.
The feeling in the room was thrilled.
The proposal crafted by President Trump's son-in-law was considered dead on arrival.
Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner earned at least $82 million last year.
Jared Kushner was denied security clearance over concerns about foreign influence, private business interests.
Do you pose a grave national security concern to the country?
Curious coincidence of Jared Kushner's failure to secure an investment from Qatar before he advised Donald Trump to support the Saudis' damaging blockade against the country.
The Crown Prince is boasting that Kushner was, quote, in his pocket.
The coronavirus hitting all-time highs.
Unnamed White House officials have described your role as being something of running a shadow task force.
The PPE has been sporadic.
The notion of the federal stockpile was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then used.
Now more than 125,000 lives lost.
40 million people have lost their jobs.
The federal government rose to the challenge, and this is a great success story.
And the hope is that by July, the country's really rocking again.
Jared's done an outstanding job.
The following statement, I apologize for looking down, but I have to, it's so fresh, it's on my phone. It literally just came in. This is from President Trump's office. It just came in a few minutes ago. As we can all relate to, everyone ends up having to bring home their work from time to time. American presidents are no different. President Trump, in order to prepare the work the next day, often took documents, including classified documents, to the residents. He had a standing order. There's the word I've been looking for. that documents removed from the Oval Office and taken to the residence were deemed to be declassified the moment he removed them. The power to classify and declassify documents rests solely with the President of the United States. The idea that some paper-pushing bureaucrat with classification authority delegated by the President needs to approve that the classification is absurd.
Scott Adams tweeted, "I will allow my government 48 hours to explain itself." And then what exactly happens after the 48 hours, what exactly the guy who did Dilbert will do is not made clear. It's kind of a vague threat, David.
What would you replace federal law enforcement? How would they be different? Because I think we do need to take a very strong look at law enforcement at every level, the local level, the state, the federal level, and look at this culture that is causing too many innocent black people to be have the hell beat out of them by rogue cops. And it also extends to a certain extent to certain federal agents. So, yeah, let's have this conversation. Let's tear it all down and see what's the best way we could build it back up. And if you want a serious conversation, Marjorie Taylor Greene, what would you propose in lieu of the FBI? How would you do it? And let's have this discussion. But I don't think she's capable of discussion, so this is probably a meaningless point on my part.
Save America. Stop communism. What does this have to do with communism? It's Joe Biden. He's basically a Republican of the 1980s. Nothing to do with collectivizing the workforce or anything. I don't even know how that would work. In January, we take on the enemy within, which I take as a threat to Republicans who aren't sufficiently combative. I think that that's talking about...
Maybe she wants another January 6th. I mean, can you imagine how crazy the vitriol would be if Christopher Wray, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, by most accounts, is a Republican who was named by Donald Trump. Well, you know, suddenly the argument goes askew. Well, what is it? Is this, but that's part of the shtick on the right, is this isn't about making sense and about having logic. This is about touching emotional feelings that a lot of Republicans and right-wing yeah. lunatics have right now, never mind whether there's any logic behind it. And I guarantee we're going to come to find out that the federal judge who signed off on this raid, I'm willing to bet that it's going to be a Trump-appointed judge. And that'll just cause, you know, the MAGA crowd to go nuts. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, then I don't know what she's going to do with her communism, but.
It was a dark day in Dallas, November 63. A day that would live on in infamy. President Kennedy was a right line. Good day to be living and a good day to die. He had led to the slaughter like a sacrificial lamb. He said, "Wait a minute, boys, you know who I am?" "Of course we do, we know who you are." Then they blew off his head while he was still in the car. Shot down like a dog in broad daylight. Was a matter of timing, and the timing was right. You got unpaid debts, we've come to collect. We're gonna kill you with hatred, without any respect. We'll mock you and shock you, and we'll put it in your face. We've already got someone here to take your place. The day they blew out the brains of the king, thousands were watching, no one saw a thing. It happened so quickly, so quick by surprise, right there in front of everyone's eyes. Greatest magic trick ever under the sun, perfectly executed, skillfully done. Wolfman, oh Wolfman, oh Wolfman, how? Rub-a-dub-dub, it's a murder most foul. Hush, little children, you'll understand. The Beatles are coming, they're gonna hold your hand. Fly down the banister, go get your coat. Harry, cross the Mersey and go for the throne.
There's three bums coming all dressed in rags. Pick up the pieces and order the flags. I'm going to Woodstock, it's the Aquarian Age. Then I'll go over to Altamont and sit near the stage. Put your head out the window, let the good times roll. There's a party going on behind the glassy door. Stack up the bricks, pour the cement. Don't say Dallas don't love you, Mr. President. Put your foot in the tank and step on the gas. Try to make it to the Triple Underpass. Blackface singer, whiteface clown. Better not show your faces after the sun goes down. I'm in the red light district like a cop on the beat. Living in a nightmare on Elm Street. When you're down on Deep Ellum, put your money in your shoe. Don't ask what your country can do for you. Cash on the ballad, money to burn. Dealey Plaza, make a left-hand turn. I'm going down to the crossroads, gonna flag a ride. The place where faith, hope, and charity die. Shoot him while he runs, boy. Shoot him while you can. See if you can shoot the invisible man. Goodbye, Charlie. Goodbye, Uncle Sam. Frankly, Miss Scarlet, I don't give a damn. What is the truth? Where did it go? Ask Oswald and Ruby Leon, I know. Shut your mouth, say it, wise old owl. Business is business, and it's a murder most foul. Tommy, can you hear me? I'm the ancient queen. I'm riding in a long black Lincoln limousine. Riding in the back seat next to my wife. Heading straight on into the afterlife. I'm leaning to the left, got my head in the left. Oh Lord, I've been led into some kind of a trap. Well, we ask no quarter. No quarter do we give. We're right down the street from the street where you live. They mutilated his body and they took out his brain. What more could they do? They piled on the pain. But his soul was not there where it was supposed to be at. For the last 50 years they've been searching for that. Freedom, oh freedom, freedom over me. I hate to tell you, mister, but only dead men are free. Send me some love, tell me no lie. Throw the gun in the gutter and walk on by. Wake up, little Susie, let's go for a drive. Cross the Trinity River, let's keep hope alive. Turn the radio on, don't touch the dials. Parkland Hospital, only 6 more miles. You got me dizzy, Miss Lizzie, you fill me with lead. magic bullet of yours has gone to my head. I'm just a Patsy like Patsy Cline. Never shot anyone from in front or behind. Got blood in my eye, got blood in my ear. I'm never gonna make it to the new frontier. Stupidest film I've seen life before. Seen it 33 times, maybe more. It's vile and deceitful, it's cruel and it's mean. Ugliest thing that you ever have seen. They killed him once and they killed him twice. Killed him like a human sacrifice. The day that they killed him, someone said to me, son, the age of the Antichrist has just only begun. Air Force One coming in through the gate. Johnson sworn in at 2:38. Let me know when you decide to throw in the towel. It is what it is, and it's murder most foul. What's new, pussycat? What'd I say? I said the soul of a nation will turn away. And it's beginning to go into a slow decay. And that it's 36 hours past Judgment Day. Wolfman Jack. He's speaking in tongues. He's going on and on at the top of his lungs. Play me a song, Mr. Wolfman Jack. Play it for me in my long Cadillac. Play me that only the good die young. Take me to the place Tom Dooley was hung. They say James Infirmary in the court of King James. If you want to remember, you better write down the names. Play it at James 2. Play it at Radical O'Brien. Play it for the man with the telepathic mind. Play John Lee Hooker. Play Scratch My Back. Play it for that strip club owner named Jack. Guitar Slim goes down slow. Play it for me and for Marilyn Monroe. Play, please don't let me be misunderstood. Play it for the first lady, she ain't feeling too good. Play Don Henley, play Glenn Frey. Take it to the limit and let it go by. Play it for Kyle Wilson too. Looking far, far away down Gower Avenue. Play Tragedy, play Twilight Time. Take me back to Tulsa to the scene of the crime. Play another one and another one bites the dust. Play the old rugged cross and in God we trust. Ride the pink horse down that long lonesome road. Stand there and wait for us to explode. Play Mystery Train for Mr. Mystery. The man who fell down dead like a rootless tree. Play it for the reverend, play it for the pastor. Play it for the dog that's got no master. They ask a Peterson, play Stan Getz, play Blue Sky, play Dickie Betts. Play Art Pepper, Thelonious Monk, Charlie Parker, and all that junk. All that junk and all that jazz. Play something for the Birdman of Alcatraz. Play Buster Keaton, play Harold Lloyd, play Bugsy Siegel, play Birdie Boy Floyd. Play the numbers, play the odds. Play Cry Me a River for the Lord of the Gods. Play number nine, play number six. Play it for Lindsay and Stevie Nicks. Play Nat King Cole, play Nature Boy. Lay down in the boondocks for Terry Marlowe. Play it happen one night and one night of sin. There's 12 million souls that are listening in. Play Merchant of Venice, play Merchants of Death. Play Stella by Starlight for Lady Macbeth. Don't worry, Mr. President. Help's on the way. Your brothers are coming. There'll be hell to pay. Brothers? What brothers? What's this about hell? Tell them we're waiting, keep coming. We'll get them as well. Love Field is where his plane touched down. But it never did get back up off of the ground. It was a hard act to follow, second to none. They killed him on the altar of the rising sun. They missed you for me and that old devil moon. Play anything goes at Memphis in June. Play Lonely as a Tomb. And Lonely are the Brave. Play it for Houdini spinning around in his grave. Play Charlie Rose Morton, play Lucille. Play Deep in a Dream and play Driving Wheel. Play Moonlight Sonata and F Sharp. And the key to the highway for the king of the heart. Play Marching to Georgia and Dumbarton Strum. Play Darkness and Death Will Come When It Comes. Play Love Me or Leave Me by the Great Bird Powell. Play the Bloodstained Banner, play Murder Most Foul.
Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan, Murder Most Foul. Off My Rough and Rowdy Ways. Check it out. They're saying it's one of the top four albums Bob Dylan has ever made. The man was 80 years old when he recorded it. Had the band ready to go on tour and COVID hit in 2020. Hardest working man in show business. It's 8:08 p.m. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Espionage Act. And I mentioned 18 Wobblies died in the Jackson County, Missouri jail in 1916. Well, by Anybody that protested the war, whether anti-capitalist like the Wobblies or anti-war generally as the socialists, because the communists were not around until 1921. So, you know, you look at the turn of the century, from the Haymarket affair to the start of the IWW, the Radical Finns started the free school the same year, 1905. 11 years later, there were bounties. And we started seeing community defense and all types of ways to counter the Klan and vigilantes. And we saw the Palmer Act that put 10,000 anti-war, anti-capitalists in jail. Ricardo Flores Magón died in Leavenworth, Kansas. Wobblies did more time in prison than German spies in World War I. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Espionage Act from a scholar. And thanks, mad props to Amy Goodman. For this one, this is Karen Greenberg, law professor, and this is 516. Hit it, Mike.
Yeah, Sean, these are heavyweight statutes. The first statute, 793, is basically the espionage statute. It talks about things that he may have done with the documents that would result in injury to this country, and willful. And he did these things willfully. That's serious enough. That's a 10-year penalty if he's convicted. Now, the third statute, which is an obstruction-related statute, carries a 20-year penalty, and it basically says that it alleges that he somehow impeded an ongoing matter, which could have been the grand jury investigation of what we now know is an espionage case. So this is a much more serious case than just possession of classified documents. Yeah, we were led to believe that this was all about just document possession and some argument about how you know getting these documents back into the archives. Far from it. They're alleging actions on the part of this ex-president and things that he has done that can only be coming from informants.
Now, the Espionage Act actually raises the specter of crimes against the country's national defense. This part of the Espionage Act that's referred to in the warrant is not the part that's about, but about the handling of national defense information. In their words, gathering, transmitting, or losing defense information. It's illegal to remove documents related to national security from their proper place, which, as we know, is the National Archives, if they could pose a threat to national security. So that's the big charge that gets all the headlines that is suspected against the president. But then there are also two other issues here, and they carry higher charges, and they're very important. One is the criminal handling of government records, the destruction, alteration, or falsification of government records or documents in investigations. And it's a prison sentence that could be up to 20 years. This is the obstruction of justice charge that is referred to. And finally, there's the potential charge of making illegal the destruction of theft of any government document. And we've seen in the recent past use of this, for example, with Petraeus and sort of allegations of this with others. But Petraeus is the name that comes to mind by this, and this is punishable by 3 years. So these are incredibly serious charges, not just in the espionage front, but in the other possible charges. Now, he hasn't been charged. This is what just said in the warrant could be what they are looking for. It justifies the search legally, and we'll see what happens. So, again, he hasn't been charged, but this is what they're looking for in the documents that they took away. And remember that some of the documents they took away were reported to be classified. So we'll see what happens. This is sort of history turning itself on its head. Obama used the Espionage Act to go against whistleblowers successfully, more than any other president in U.S. history in that way. But the Espionage Act, you know, started in World War I and was used primarily at the time to prosecute successfully those who opposed the war, World War One, and enlistment in the war. And so, and it's been used during the McCarthy era. It's been used, it was tried to be used against Daniel Ellsberg over the Pentagon Papers. It has a long history of not really being about what it's being used for now, which is the abuse of power. This is the suspicion. The abuse of power at the absolute highest level of government to harm the country, as opposed to these prior incidents we referred to, which were people who were trying to leak information in order to bring to light some things that they thought and others thought were things that the government shouldn't be doing. And so the difference between dissent and the use of the espionage to prosecute dissent and the abuse of power in a way that, that potentially harms national security, I would argue are two very different things. And again, I think the country needs to have a discussion about this. But right now we need to handle what happened, what those documents were about, if we can find out, and what the president was intending, the former president was intending by holding on to these documents. Well, that means a number of things. One, it obviously is the sort of one of the scarier things that you could be worried about in terms of holding on. The president has claimed he can declassify information, and we think this is going to be part of what is said by his defense team, and that he can sort of take a magic wand and just declassify things. There, when it comes to nuclear issues and nuclear weapons, that is not, first of all, it's not necessarily the case anyway without going through a series of procedures and conversations and document by document removal of these from, you know, the, a large cache that, you, that you're going to turn over to the National Archives. But when it comes to nuclear issues, it's actually a different standard, and the president does not have the right to do this just the way he's claiming, and this is regulated by the Atomic Energy Act. So I think it's rather significant that they mentioned, that it's been mentioned and reported that this may pertain to some nuclear issues.
I think constitutionally back, I believe it was in 1988, there was a Supreme Court decision, U.S. Navy versus Egan, in which they actually talked about whether or not a form or a president could classify and declassify, and it's never really been litigated, but it appears that a president can classify or perhaps declassify information. And if that's the case, then the question would be, and I think it will be litigated as this moves forward, whether or not that was completed while the president was in the White House at that time.
Well, you can sort of understand from the former president's point of view why he would want to say that, because it gets him out of the more serious charges about mishandling classified documents, which brings, you know, which brings very high charges. And so I think I understand it from the point of view of the defense, but it's not accurate. When you declassify a document, if you want to declassify a document and you're a president, there are procedures, there are rules, there are conversations, there should be a record of that, getting to the point about this willful misuse of records within this presidency. And we don't know whether there will be something in what they took from Mar-a-Lago last week, whether there will be something that shows documents that he went through procedures to declassify. But it's not just a carte blanche on declassifying a whole set of information. This is a scrutinized, articulable distinction about what should be classified and what wasn't. And so we'd have to see what those conversations were, if they took place, whether there's a record. And to this point, we haven't seen that.
Can you talk about the verbal attacks on the FBI and the Justice Department on Trump and his allies? The attorney who represents whistleblowers, Mark Zaid, tweeted, quote, Trump, via Breitbart, released unredacted copy of property receipt containing names of FBI agents. Based on his history, this can only be interpreted as intentional to cause these special agents, one of whom I know, and their families grief and subject them to possible threats, Mark Zaid said. Your response, Karen Greenberg?
You know, my response is that this is just a replay on a different level, in a different arena, of January 6th. This is the call to violence on behalf of the former president, and his treatment this time under the law. And it's a convergence of many things that have been going on in this country for a long time. So we now know the narrative. We now see how it plays out. And it is very serious and it is very dangerous. And this is a pivotal moment. Either as a country, we know how to handle such threats or we don't. And that includes how we apply the Espionage Act, how we use our courts, how we protect our law enforcement. And this is a pivotal moment and it matters how this is resolved. It just can't keep going on that that the use of the courts on the rule of law is countered by violence that refuses to accept it. So again, this goes to something that we've been seeing throughout the January 6th investigation and elsewhere, a willful use of, you want to call it disinformation, of lying, of distorting the record. And it's going to take a long time to put together this story of what actually went on with these documents that were kept at Mar-a-Lago. It's all part of a larger story, which is what went on inside the Trump administration, what's fact and what's fiction, and what that means. And this is one of the most important things about these records that we sort of minimize because we're thinking about the guilt or innocence of the former president, which is that we preserve records for a reason. We preserve them, yes, so that we can understand guilt or innocence, but we also preserve them so that we know what happened in our country, so that we have the historical record, so that we know how to go forward should we decide to take steps towards legislation that will prevent any of this from happening again in the future. So it's not a minor point, and we're going to need to pay attention to this. The classification issue is going to come up, we think, in any kind of investigation going forward. So yes, you could try to separate it out. But when you're talking about national defense information, whether or not it was classified is going to make a difference. And the fact that there are classified documents, whether or not they go after it on that specific point, which I think they will, is what is involved with the issue of did he do things that could have potentially harmed national security. So the classification issue just sheds a brighter light on that basic fundamental issue in this case. I'm always concerned about an overall backlash. I don't think we can worry about it. I think we have to go forward and really find out what happened. When you ask about what's the most concern, we need to know what these documents were, and we're not going to know all of it. Some of it's going to have to be classified. But essentially what these documents were, what countries, if any other countries, were involved or named in these documents, what these documents addressed. Try to understand former President Trump intended to do with this material. Why did he keep it? Was it to cover up the crimes from the past or worries about being allegations that address the past? Or was it information that could have been weaponized for other purposes? We have no idea, but this is what we need to know in coming days.
You know, we're back. It's 8:22 p.m. in the lower Midwest, out here on the southern prairie. And we had a lot of rain, had a thunderstorm last night, rained all day. Des Moines got slammed, and lots of pictures of tornadoes on Twitter, which is makes a wonderful Friday for it being the best night for news on Twitter, in my opinion. But you know, when we started out the spring, we declared this the summer of Sam, and y'all might recall the summer of Sam, 1976, when the New York blackouts, and it was the birth of hip hop. And Blondie come out with Rapture as the first hip-hop song to break the top 40. But, yeah, so, you know, people don't complain that we pick on Sam Brownback still. Now, he's over there doing grain shipments in the Ukraine right now, you know, because – you know, he's a preacher and with a degree in business agriculture. Married into money. It sounds like John McCain. Sounds like you know, General MacArthur. Sounds like George Shultz. But nevertheless, compared to Sam Brownback, Dave Berkowitz was just another mail carrier. Now think about it. So anyway, we're going to go on to the next clip, and this was 5:15, Mike. Hit it.
Were they kept at Mar-a-Lago? How many people potentially had access to them while they were kept at Mar-a-Lago?
We're truly in uncharted waters, and Friday's release of details about what the FBI discovered during that unprecedented search at Mar-a-Lago is stunning. Documents and secrets so sensitive that the nation's security was potentially put at grave risk.
New concerns over the potentially extraordinary risks to national security posed by the discovery of classified information allegedly seized from former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago home. ABC News learning that top law enforcement officials must now try to track the chain of custody of those national secrets in an urgent effort to find out if any of the material allegedly taken from the White House was compromised.
The investigation will likely include interviewing former Trump administration officials and may even involve checking for fingerprints on the recovered classified documents to better understand who might have had access to them. The Justice Department warrant unsealed Friday raises the prospect of espionage charges and obstruction of justice, revealing 11 sets of recovered documents ranging from confidential to secret, top secret, and even top secret SCI, meaning that it came from intelligence sources and could involve nuclear secrets and information about terrorism operations. SCI material often involves intelligence from allies, spying, electronic eavesdropping, or informants. It's supposed to be viewed only in the most secure designated locations and by officials with the highest security clearances. Federal security protocols flatly state the compromise of top secret material creates the potential for exceptionally grave damage to national security. The Justice Department had been negotiating for these documents for weeks, eventually subpoenaing them.
Short of the nuclear codes being written on these documents in a locked behind closed doors, I just really don't understand how a document could warrant this kind of warrant.
Eventually.
And they better come up with something, honestly, more egregious than the nuclear codes. Codes.
How long were they kept at Mar-a-Lago? How many people potentially had access to them while they were kept at Mar-a-Lago?
Rudy Giuliani, who once served as former President Trump's personal attorney, he's been ordered to appear before a Georgia special grand jury. This is part of the ongoing criminal investigation into Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election results in Georgia, where Giuliani claimed there was widespread voter fraud after watching edited surveillance video of ballots being tabulated at State Farm Arena in Atlanta. ABC's Zareen Shah joins me now with more. So this has been an allegation that was debunked by Georgia Republican officials, right? The Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, the Governor Brian Kemp, and the people of Georgia recognized that their 2020 election was free and fair. But what's this grand jury going to do with Giuliani?
Good afternoon, Terry. They hope to learn anything they possibly can. Look, Giuliani was Trump's personal lawyer. He was one of the closest people to him during this time, and he was leading the legal effort. So the big question now is, how were Trump and his allies involved in Georgia and potentially meddling in that election there? We know the big one, right? Trump called Georgia Secretary of State. He asked him to find 11,000 votes. But what else? Well, there are 16 electors who voted for Trump in that state, who falsely voted for Donald Trump when Biden actually won the election in Georgia. So we know right now that Giuliani is supposed to show up in court on August 9th, but he was already supposed to show up in court in New York on this very topic earlier this month, and he didn't. So we'll have to see what happens.
And Giuliani had appeared before the Georgia lawmakers in December 2020 as he was kind of barnstorming the country with that kind of road show going before various legislatures with his theories of why the election was stolen, rejected by those Republican-controlled legislators. How is this going to be different when and if he does comply with subpoena, Giuliani goes to Georgia again now?
Yeah, and I think the big question is it going to be different, right? This is a year and a half later. We know that he showed up in front of Georgia lawmakers back then. He gave testimony. He gave witnesses. He apparently gave evidence of voter fraud, even though there wasn't any. That was disproven very soon afterward. But he kept claiming that there was. So is this going to be different, Terry? We don't know. We'll have to see.
And this all comes a day before the next January 6th committee hearing, the fallout from those deleted Secret Service text messages. So what's the latest on that story?
I think a lot of us are just scratching our head. How did this happen? How did so many texts get deleted? We know when they were subpoenaed, right? They were subpoenaed on January 16th. The ones that were subpoenaed were for January 5th and January 6th. And then all of a sudden, there was this migration of text messages that was apparently scheduled to take place, and that was for January 25th. So the big question now is, what happened to all those text messages? Can you get any of them back? So far, just one was handed over, but there is, of course, hope that potentially more can be found.
A lot of conspiracy theories out there, but when it comes to government, the screw-up is probably more likely than a conspiracy. Two more aides now from the Trump White House are expected to testify before the House committee tomorrow in its what might be its final hearing. Who are they? What's this going to look like?
Yeah, so two former White House officials. One of them is Matthew Pottinger. He was the national security, he's on Trump's National Security Council. He resigned the very day after January 6th. And then you have the deputy press secretary. Her name is Sarah Matthews. She was under Kayleigh McEnany. She resigned just hours after the attack happened. She said that she was just really disturbed by seeing the attack. She believes in a peaceful transfer of power. And she also spoke out about Cassidy Hutchinson. She showed her support for Hutchinson. that testimony that Hutchinson gave a few weeks ago, very, very hard to forget. Incredibly powerful testimony, and we'll see how these two former White House officials do tomorrow as well.
A number of witnesses in these hearings have been Republicans in the state level and in Trump's own government. Zareen Shah, thanks very much for that.
Thanks.
Them bites clean, polish that thing, and it looks her over more than me. But I won't let it get to me. Yeah, he can play with his machine. Night and day. Stop your screaming.
Yeah.
PJ Harvey Band, live in Argentina, 2017. Check it out on YouTube, folks. You won't be disappointed. Okay, so we got a Tennessee teacher that had all her books being censored. I kind of gave it a setup earlier when we started the podcast, but it's really good. This is from TennesseeHoller.com, and it's 518. Hit it, Mike.
Hi, it's me. In my classroom on a Saturday, and you're probably wondering why, because most teachers, like myself, don't believe in coming to work on the weekend. But let me tell you why. If you're a Tennessee teacher, you know why I'm here, because I'm sitting in front of my classroom library on a Saturday because the Tennessee General Assembly passed a law that basically says if a teacher wants his or her students to read any of the books at school or in the teacher's classroom, the teacher has to catalog every single book. So most teachers have hundreds of books. Some, I would say thousands. They have to catalog all of them. Once they catalog them, they send them to their school library. The librarian has a list of books that are approved or not approved based on, I don't even know what, honestly. Then from the list that wasn't approved that she didn't have, she sends that to someone higher up. I'm assuming that it's probably someone that's never even been in a classroom, that's never taught children. That's neither here nor there. And then they go through the list of books that she didn't have. And then they determine whether these books are appropriate, not appropriate, whether they're approved or not. So I have to go through all the books again after I do all that. Then I have to post that list online for all my parents to see in case they want to chime in about the books that are in my classroom. And then after that, the kids can start reading the books. And you're like, I wouldn't do all that. And we don't have to. Our district's great. They're like, we do realize this is going to take you quite a bit of your own time. But here's the thing. We're doing a lot of benchmark assessments, pre-assessments, trying to figure out where kids are. The kids want to read books because if they finish early or something, they're asking. The kids in here are asking me, can I go get a book and read? And they're so excited. And I have to say no because I haven't had a chance to go through all of them, to catalog them, to write them all down, to send off to somebody that is going to tell me, them, if they can or cannot read the books in my classroom library. The greedy triangle.
Thank you so much for cleaning up the ketchup, my friend. That was really responsible, and I appreciate that. Are you feeling calm and safe and ready to talk? Okay, great. How are you feeling now? Sad. Yeah, I get it. Frustrated, maybe? Me too. Do you understand why they took those items from you? No, not for no reason, friend. Those did not belong to you. You took them home, and you were not supposed to, so they took them back. The FBI. Yeah. We need to start taking some responsibility for our actions. Do you know what responsibility means? Listen, everybody makes mistakes, okay? Even grown-ups make... You're a grown-up. Okay. No, honey, we cannot go play golf right now. We need to stay inside. Okay.
On political corruption, we are going to restore honor to our government. In my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law, the law, the law, the law, the law.
And what happened was President Trump substituted me in to be his representative at the National Archives because we did big declass at the end of the Trump administration. And his cronies actually bureaucratically stopped the declassification process. The commander-in-chief said declassified to this mountain of documents, and he walked out, and his cronies were like, well, we're not going to exactly do that. So now we're in this fight, and people think I can just walk down to the National Archives and like throw it in my, you know, my backpack and walk out. I'm working on it. And, of course, the bureaucracy is getting in the way, but that's not going to stop us. I will be going to the National Archives in the coming weeks. I will be identifying those documents, and I will be demanding that they be released because they are already declassified. The reason they're not released is because they show more corruption at the FBI and DOJ, just like we showed during our Russiagate investigation when Devin and I landed. With Devin and I have always said, the American public has only seen 60% of what we've been able to see.
Wow.
So just imagine that, 60% and you have the biggest criminal scandal in U.S. history. Why won't they release the other 40%? The same reason they didn't want to release the first 60%. It shows corruption at the highest levels. It shows politicization. It shows political enemies using the intelligence system and law enforcement to prosecute a political vendetta, which should never be allowed. So I am going to continue that work at the National Archives. I apologize. I can't get it declassified overnight, but I'm on it.
Press Conference, a series in which men who make the news answer impromptu questions from men who write the news. They are introduced by William Clark.
Good evening. This week, more than perhaps ever before, our thoughts are on Asia. And we have the exceptional good fortune to have in the studio tonight one of Asia's most prominent statesmen, the Prime Minister of India. Mr. Nehru, I am extremely grateful to you for coming here, and I speak on behalf of us here and on behalf of the wider public who are watching us. I'm particularly grateful as I believe this is your very first appearance on television.
Yes, this is the first time I'm facing this ordeal. In fact, I know very little about television, except what I've heard about it.
Well, I would like to introduce to you, if I may, the people who are, I hope, going to make this not such a bad ordeal after all. Sitting on my left is Kingsley Martin, the editor of the New Statesman and Nation. And beyond him is H.V. Hudson, the editor of the Sunday Times. And at the end, to ask the first question, is Donald McLaughlin, the foreign editor of The Economist.
Prime Minister, when you return to India, people will be asking you what you thought of the coronation. What are you going to tell them?
Well, I'll have to tell them a great deal. But principally that it's very impressive in many ways. The most impressive thing to me was, apart from it being a great spectacle, were the crowds here and the way they behaved. And one begins to like more and more the London crowds and their fortitude in inclement weather and their insistence on enjoying themselves, whatever might happen.
But is there going to be no criticism in India of your having come to the coronation?
There was when I came, and there will be, no doubt, when I go back. But I don't think it will amount to much.
Mr. Nehru, we all understand very well indeed why India decided to be a republic within the Commonwealth. What I think is a remarkable thing is why there is so little resentment in India towards the British in view of our past history. It seems to us that India is a most wonderfully magnanimous country. Can you explain this remarkable phenomenon of forgiveness?
Well, partly we don't, I suppose, hate for long or intensively, but chiefly I think because of the background that Mr. Gandhi gave us during all these past decades.
Mm. After all, you were in prison yourself 16 years, and you don't seem to have any resentment about it at all. We might almost be popular people in India. An astonishing thing.
America.
PJ Harvey. That's it for tonight, folks. Thanks for tuning in. And we'll keep you updated next week at 7 p.m. on the Abolitionist Hour. Don't forget to write Eric King. And we got the Missouri Department of Correction Town Hall Meeting. Just Google that. MODOC Town Hall Meeting. You have to sign up ahead of time and get on the list. And it's a public forum. And they're going to go through and take questions.
Slim's songs. They go wild, simply wild over me. Although I've never done them harm that I can see. I'm as gentle as a lamb, but they take me for a ram. They go wild, simply wild over me. Oh, the cop, he went wild over me. And he held his gun where everyone could see. He was breathing rather hard when he saw my union card. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the judge, he went wild over me. And I plainly saw we never could agree. But so I let the man obey what his conscience had to say. He went wild, simply wild over me. Then the jailer, he went wild over me. When he locked me up and threw away the key. Oh, it seemed to be the rage to keep me in a cage. He went wild, simply wild over me. Now they go wild, simply wild over me. I'm referring to the bed bug and the flea. Oh, they murmur in my sleep. They disturb my slumber deep. They go wild, simply wild over me. Will the roses grow wild over me when I've gone into the land that is to be? When my soul and body part in the stillness of my heart, will the roses grow wild over me? Well, and God, he went wild over me. When I knelt beside the throne on bended knee. When the angels heard me yell, they shot me down to hell. But they went wild, simply wild over me.